It's done.
Connor McDavid! It's not real!
The goal of the year?
Panarin!
Part of the past. The celebrations? Forgotten. The history?
Vegas Golden Knights!
History. We're back to a blank slate. Clean ice. All that matters now is what happens next. The Stanley Cup Playoffs.
Eastern Conference Final begins Wednesday.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Hello and welcome to the Carlton Blue podcast. I'm your host, Dan Rowlandson, joined by John Townley for this one. This podcast is sponsored by NordVPN, and all the information you need to get the best discount code available is in the podcast description below. Now, John, we normally have a bit of chit-chat before we start, but we're a little bit up against the clock today, so we'll do the small talk on air. How are you, mate? Everything okay? Nice morning?
Yeah. All good, thank you. Are you okay?
I'm well, yes. It's a nice sunny day. Got a coffee. Happy here to be talking about Aston Villa, as always. Loads and loads of questions to get through, so we normally have a little bit of a chat about the most recent game and our thoughts and feelings, and that will come up in the questions, so I'm going to dive straight into it. The first one is not a question, but something I saw on social media from AVFC Stato, and it was Villa's league trajectory over the course of the season. Villa have not dropped out of the top five since game week 7, which is something we don't really ever consider and talk about. That's very, very impressive. I kind of tweeted in jest that the first input of this graph is 20th place on match day one when we lose 5-1 to Newcastle. And I tweeted 20th to 4th. Unai Emery does it again. What a genius. But that rise from 20th to 5th by game week 7. We've not dropped out of the top five since. I mean, pretty much from game week 13, we've not dropped out of the top four, really. Only three occasions that we've dropped down to fifth. And that was only three individual game weeks, and it's back up to fourth again. But to have that impressive consistency is something that should be applauded and should be celebrated. That there really should be a dip in that graph when Kamara gets injured, or Pau Torres is out for 3 or 4 games, or Ezri Konsa gets his injury. Like, to see ups and downs in there would be normal and expected given what we've gone through. So to be fifth since game week 7 and now up into fourth pretty consistently from game week 24, 25, that's special.
Yeah, now you just hope that we'll be rewarded with fourth position at the end of May. It doesn't feel like we ever dropped out of the top four, definitely five, you know, maybe once, or, you know, it's the very start of the season. But when have we been behind, like, Man United or Newcastle, Chelsea? You know, we haven't, you know, for more than a few days. So, yeah, I'm not, like, surprised by that graph at all. We do always say Villa are probably the fourth best team, or they are the fourth best team, because we've been there the longest. Didn't know that for absolute certain, but it felt like when have we been behind Tottenham very often? Like, very rarely. So, it's full testament to the job Emery's done, and, as you say, the stuff that he's been dealing with. That we've, like, three games of the season remaining. I think Man United might have four, but they can't catch us, and it's the first time we'll finish above them in the Premier League era, isn't it? So, remarkable season so far. It's just that because we've been here for so long, it's difficult to kind of really celebrate what we've done yet, because we know that around the corner is something that will be something remarkable. So at the end of the season, if we were to finish fifth, it would be, you know, gutting and disappointing, but then in the kind of the weeks to follow, I think we'd still think, well, you know what, that was probably the best season we've had for, you know, donkey's years, and we're climbing the ladder. We're now in the Europa League, and we've got the best manager to win that competition anyway. Whatever it is, it's positive. It's just that we've put the party on hold as such, because we know that Well, we've got two things to chase. Hopefully by Thursday night we can have, you know, kind of one foot in the final as such, although that's kind of a dangerous game to play anyway. But I think if we can get a 2-goal lead, then we'll be okay. And yeah, we can then go after the top four with three games remaining. Brighton's a huge game as well, as we'll touch on. But yeah, it's very exciting.
Yeah, it is. We'll talk about the permutations in a second. I'm going to start with the questions then from KT3 Villain, who says, our worst performances have come against teams in our immediate vicinity. Newcastle, Man United, Chelsea twice in the league and the cup, Tottenham. Why do we think we put in such different performances against the big boys versus the best of the rest?
The Newcastle and United ones, those are the two, or the four games, shall I say, that were really difficult. But again, I've answered this in a different way previously of saying each one has its own bit of context, though, because the Newcastle game was, you know, the first game of the season, Tyrone Mings playing at St. James's. That was always going to be a terribly difficult game anyway. And that was their fully fit team. They had Tonali, they had Barnes, they had everyone else. And the United game, we were 2-0 up at half time. We should see that out. And that, in its own way, was just a strange one. Liverpool have struggled at Old Trafford this season. They played two games, didn't win. Had a similar game to us when we lost 3-2 and they lost in the FA Cup. You know, United coming back and they have to kind of use the energy of Old Trafford. So that was that game. And the Newcastle and Man United matches after the new year, we had a dip in the new year, after the new year, didn't we? I don't know exactly what that was, but we kind of plateaued a little bit. And because we were so far ahead of them, I think that maybe played its part into it. We probably thought that, you know, yes, it would have put a huge distance between ourselves and United at the time, but we probably thought, well, we'll be okay. United aren't particularly good at home. We'll be able to beat them. And it didn't work out like that. And the Newcastle game, again, we concede from two corners. If you're going to concede two corners in any Premier League game, then you're well up against it, aren't you? So, I think a lot of context is involved in that. I think, you know, going back to that graph that we just seen then, Villa have been incredibly consistent throughout the whole season. So although our losses have been grouped against those teams, there isn't like a worry there for me. I think next season, are we going to lose to them twice again? Don't think so. Yeah, exactly. I'm okay with it. We played better than United, home and away. You know, yes, we had a collapse in the second half, but we were still better than them, I think, over the course of the match. We could have gone 3-1 ahead when John McGinn had a chance, or 3-2. Was it? They're just things that happen in the season. I don't look at it and think we were buckling under pressure, whatever it was. So,
Okay, right. These questions are in a random order, so forgive me if this goes a little bit all over the place. Simon says, will Konsa overtake Barry in terms of appearances for Villa? Now, just off the Wikipedia numbers, because that's the easiest to get to, Konsa has 160 appearances versus Gareth Barry's 365. So he's 200 away from getting close to it, which I think that's total appearances, which is probably another four seasons at least if Villa play 50 games a year.
Yeah, are we going off Premier League or just?
I think that's total appearances, but yeah, even so, like, it's still going to be a
Barry,
lot.
Yeah, Barry obviously played in European competition for us and in cups as well. Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, he can for sure. If he stays with us for another, I'd say probably 5 to 6 years, he'd break that. But obviously, that's, staying at Villa for pretty much his whole career. I know Barry didn't, and he still made lots more appearances, but how old is Konsa now? 25, I believe. There's a lot of football for him to play in his career, but equally 26. Okay, so 5 seasons takes him up to his 30. So, there's no reason why he can't stay at Villa throughout his whole career. And he's always present. He's always, he obviously had that one knee injury that kept him out, even just for like 2 weeks that was. So, he's very reliable in terms of his fitness. He's always available. He absolutely can do that.
For some reason, I thought he was slightly older than that as well. I don't know why.
His 21, didn't we? So.
I suppose it's probably because he's already been here for quite a while already. But you would be talking about him having a 10-year career at Villa for him to get close to that, which is not beyond the realms of possibility. But he's that good that you do think, well, if Villa, I don't want to go into this, but if Villa do drop off in 3 or 4 years, then he could probably get a move elsewhere and he doesn't get anywhere near it. But if Villa are good for the next 5 or 6 years and he's here and still starting every game, there's every reason he can get it. If he was already, in my mind, I had him at 29 for some reason. If he was already around then, I'd be thinking, well, he's not going to do it. I know he's a young player, but 26, I don't know, it's just kind of crept up on me how young he was when we signed him. Absolutely, he could do it, but it's some task to catch Gareth Barry's number of appearances from whoever it is.
Yeah, it is. But I think being a defender and as reliable as he is, and there's no one that you'd play in front of Conte, even if he were to sign two new centre-backs. He's had that whole thing throughout his Villa career of, we've signed this player, will it displace Conte? No. Will it displace Conte? No. He's just kind of overcome each one to the point where it's like, okay, well, actually, he's the best defender that
he's
have.
He's the main man, yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah, I like to see him back in that central defensive role as well. I know at right back, it allows us to do different things.
But allows him to get some more appearances.
Yeah. You can't get away from the fact that when someone goes near Conte, it just makes it look so easy. He's defending. Mm. And he's a leader as well at the back. And I was, in the summer, can we look at maybe buying a right back, maybe even someone who can do a similar role to Conte? I know there's been a few names linked already in that kind of position. So we'll see what the summer brings.
It's permutations time. This is where we talk about Spurs. I should get a little overlay for that, shouldn't I? Permutations. I don't want to go into this too much because, as we said, it's very difficult to predict every game. And we're not going to do that now. We're just going to look at the bigger picture for the rest of the season. It's 3 games left for us, 5 games for Spurs. Gary says, do you think one more win will secure Champions League football? I really believe Spurs will only win 2 of their remaining 5 fixtures and maybe 2 draws. So that would put them on 68. Villa are on 67 now. So one more win in Gary's world would be enough. I don't want to look. I know that you're about to tell us various different things that can happen in the remaining season. You sent me about 10 minutes worth of voice notes yesterday doing similar. So I'll allow you that space in a second. For me, I'm just focused on this week, and it relies on Spurs losing, obviously, but let's just pretend for a minute. So big night Thursday with Villa playing Olympiacos. Spurs head to Chelsea. If Chelsea play as they did against us, Chelsea got a great chance there. So if Spurs lose on Thursday, we beat Brighton on Sunday, and then Liverpool beat Spurs on Sunday afternoon as well, that would guarantee top 4. Less than a week, we could be talking here this time next week about having secured Champions League football. To do that, Spurs have to lose 2, we have to beat Brighton. All those things may not happen, but that's like the immediate permutations that I'm kind of focused on. If Chelsea were to lose, if Spurs were to win Thursday, all that goes out the window till next week at least. But if they do lose, I'll then be going, Brighton's massive now, if we like Liverpool, you know, really going in for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Tell me the bigger picture.
It's the first thing I told my brother when I woke up. So I didn't even say, you're right. I went, dived in, I said, I've done the maths. It is the picture. Firstly, what I would say is, I think Spurs are capable of putting together a run where they get more than 70. Because even though they lost to Arsenal, and I know they're open at the back, they still miss loads of chances. They're the worst team for us to be kind of competing with, because they're constantly attacking and they're constantly making opportunities, and Romero should have scored. They had the chances. Son should have scored before half-time. So what I would say firstly is, and I think a lot of Villa fans will kind of want to know this bit, but my main fear is the final day. So for it not to go down to the final day, if Villa win one more game, they put them on 70, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that one of the next 2, if they beat either Brighton or Liverpool, they're on 70. For Villa to only need a point on the final day to get Champions League, Tottenham will have to get to 67. Sorry. So that's, what are they, 2 wins and a draw from 4 games against Chelsea, Liverpool, Burnley and City.
Yeah,
I think we have to kind of class, although Burnley are, you know, fighting and they could do something against Tottenham. For the sake of this, we need to count that as a win. So that means that Tottenham would have to beat one of Chelsea, Liverpool or City and then draw another. So one win, one draw, one defeat in those 3 games. That puts them up to 67.
Yeah, and that feels doable.
Yeah, doable, but still they need to do it, right? And Villa, say if they win a game, they'll be on 70. So Villa would only need a point to win Champions League against Palace, which, you know, for me sounds brilliant. What I don't want to do is go down to the last day and we need to win and then we're looking at Spurs thinking, well, if Spurs score more goals than us, that stuff, because then it feels out of our hands a little bit and there's a lot of pressure there. I don't think we've been playing with much pressure throughout the season. I know that sounds mad, but I still feel like we're the team who we're just doing our business. We're just going. We're not really bothered about what Spurs are doing because we're 7 points ahead or we're 8 points ahead. It didn't feel like they're that close. But if they were to beat Chelsea, if they were to get something at Liverpool, then it is tight. Then it gets to the point of like, okay, we need City to win. We have to pray that they don't beat Liverpool, you know, that sort of stuff. My main permutation is if Villa get 4 points, I know I've just said about the final day, but if they just get 4 points, that puts them on 71. Tottenham can only better that if they win 4 of their 5 games, which I think, you know, they could do, but that's very difficult. That's basically beating everyone but City, or beating everyone but Liverpool away. That would be difficult for them, I think. But I say that, I do think if they were to win quite a few games and we get 4 points, so one win, the goal difference is going to be really tight as well, because the goal difference is, what, -6 or -7 potentially? Don't want to fall into the trap of they're on the beach and they haven't won in this long, so Villa should go there
literally
and win.
On the beach, yeah.
But we should win that game. Yeah, if we give our best performance, we'll win. That's as simple as it needs to be. And again, we're not playing with like immediate pressure, because we're thinking, well, you know, with this ahead, sorry, this amount of points ahead, if we win this, we go to 70 with two games left. Like, what an opportunity. Whereas on the final day, if we have to win, because Tottenham will beat Sheffield United, that's a different ball game then. And, you know, I back us to do it, but we haven't really had that game yet this season where kind of like a season defining. I know the Lille game felt like that, and we just about got over the line in the end. But I've said for a while, we just need to amass as many points as we can before we build pressure on ourselves, and we have the opportunity against Brighton. If we can win that, we're in a really good position then. And say, just hope that Tottenham don't beat either Liverpool or Chelsea. I mean, ideally lose both, as you say, Dan, but I can't see that. I think they could possibly take 4 points, if I'm being honest.
If we beat Brighton, we've gone a long way to doing most of the job ourselves. And like I think you said a couple of weeks ago, if we don't do it from this position, to a certain extent, you have to say fair play to Spurs for getting so many points from such a difficult run of form. If they do win 4 out of 5, very little we can do about that unless we win 3 out of 3, which...
Well, if they win...
Possible, but yeah.
Yeah, if they win 4 out of 5, then we just need to win 2, which again, you know, sounds okay for me. I think we can beat Palace, we can beat Liverpool if we have to. You know, if we're going into that Liverpool game, whatever we do against Brighton, because I don't think we'll lose to Brighton. If we get a point against Brighton, we'll be then going into the Liverpool game thinking, right, Monday night, under the lights, if we win this, we go to, what would it be, 71 points. That could be the total we need. So each one of those games feels like if we win, we're nearly there, or we're all but there.
We've kind of got 3 chances, haven't we, at getting over the line, 3 match points, if you like, if you want to have a tennis analogy.
Yeah, so I think we can win individually any of those 3 games, if not all of them. I know that would be difficult, but you know, if I was a Tottenham fan, I'd be looking at probably thinking Villa can take 7 points from those games. They can win 2 and draw 1. I absolutely think that's doable for us. But as a Villa fan, I'm trying to kind of underestimate us a little bit to kind of give ourselves like a realistic view of what is in front of us. And I think 4 points is absolutely achievable. And I think that's, you know, kind of if we work with that, then what have Tottenham got to do to get to us? And they still need to put on a good run of form to get there, let alone, as I say, the fact that Villa could probably get more than 4 points anyway.
Even if we're saying it just to 70 points is only 3, that's underestimating Villa's average performance points per game by half. We're averaging pretty much 2 points a game. To get 3 points from 3 is 1 point a game, obviously. If the win doesn't come against Brighton, we still have to get 3 points from 2 games remaining. And if it doesn't come against Liverpool, it has to be against Palace. Like, at this stage of the season, it's obviously the points are important. It's stupid to say they're not. But it's about games running out for Spurs. If they don't beat Chelsea and they don't beat Spurs, don't beat Liverpool, yes, they can still catch our points total. But now the games they can do it in is dramatically less.
To kind of flip it again, you could say if we only win 1 game or draw 3, then Tottenham, to get to 70 points themselves, to get to 71 would be 3 wins and 2 draws. So 2 wins against Burnley and Sheffield, then they'd have to beat one of Chelsea, Liverpool or City and then draw the other 2, which again, you know, that's them going and beating, which I don't think Tottenham have done for a long time, going beating in 5 or whatever, especially against this level of team. So it's stacked against Spurs. They can definitely do it, because all they've got to do is beat Chelsea, and then all of a sudden it's on Villa to be like, we need to get a win here against Brighton. But if we focus on ourselves, we're sound.
David says, and a lot of people ask this actually after Sheffield United's relegation was confirmed this weekend, do we have to buy Archer back, and what does the future hold from him if we do? And we've spoken about this before, haven't we? It's a obligation, I think it was, as part of the deal, that all the contracts and everything are already arranged, that if Sheffield United go down, there's a clause where Villa activate a X amount price to get him back. So Sheffield United, so Cameron Archer will be a Villa player again at the end of the season. What happens to him long term, whether he sticks around and gets into the squad and provides some depth for us, whether he goes out on loan or there's another deal to be done for a permanent sale next summer, how do you assess that situation quickly?
Would I guess he gets sold? That would be Villa's task, to sell players that they don't need in the summer to raise funds.
A loan doesn't do much for us at this stage, does it?
No, nothing. I mean, the only thing alone would do is if you loaned him to a championship team and he proves himself again, even though he already has, and then someone else buys him. But football, how do I say it? People who work in football clubs on transfers, recruitment, sorry, they'll be well aware of what Archer can do at different levels and with what players as well. I always said that a move to Leicester would probably work for him. They would probably buy him even in the championship. So, yeah, I don't know. There'll be interest from a number of clubs and a number of teams looking at him and thinking, what can he do at that level? Is the price right? Because, again, he's probably not going to be starting for any Premier League team. But there's certainly a talent there and someone that could be nurtured. And I think in a team like Leicester, who's got quality around him, more quality than Sheffield United anyway, you know, he's got a chance of making a success of himself then as a Premier League player in a Premier League squad. So, yeah, it's a shame that he didn't quite work for him at Sheffield United. And it's kind of disappointing. It's disappointing for Villa, really, because they had a good deal there and it's not going to materialise exactly how they wanted it to. And his value has obviously gone down now, but hopefully they can negotiate something with the club.
Mm. Okay, next question. Brent says, do you think trying to get to the 20-goal target has affected Ollie Watkins' normal game in the last two matches? Or do you think the Chelsea game was just an off night?
I said that second half against Bournemouth was probably the best I've seen Ollie Watkins play. So I can't. No way is he out of form or... I wouldn't read into any of that. He'll score another few goals just before the end of the season, I've no doubt. Whether that's enough for the Golden Boot, I think we said in a previous podcast, then with Dan, it's going to be difficult for him to do because there's a lot of players going for it. Isak, Palmer scores penalties, and obviously Haaland scored again against Forest. So, yeah, difficult for Watkins to get the Golden Boot now, I'd have thought. But still, he's got individual targets to go for, I suppose. You say 20 goals. For a Villa player in the Premier League. And if he gets another three, for example, that's going to be very difficult for anyone to beat, even himself, next season. So no doubts about Watkins, he'll be fine.
Yeah, he will score, I think, another two goals in the Premier League, which will take him to 21. Haaland's on 21. So I don't think he will do enough to win the Golden Boot now. He probably needs four, I'd suggest, in his last three to have a chance, possibly five. Yeah. Isak scores a hat-trick against somebody and he wins it. Like it is that close. But getting 20 goals for Villa would be a nice thing for us. But Villa finishing in the top four is much more important. If we finish in the top four and Watkins doesn't score another goal, fine. Caroline asks, do you think Emi Martinez was taken off as a precaution to give Robin Olsen minutes before he has to play on Thursday night? Now, there's some questions about, does Robin Olsen play on Thursday night or do we give Gauci a go? I think it will be Olsen to throw Gauci in that magnitude of game, I think would be a mistake, given that we haven't seen anything from him. Martinez was a hamstring issue. I think as of Monday morning, we still don't quite know the severity of it. If it's a strain, it could be 2 or 3 weeks and end of season stuff for him. If it's just a bit of tightness, it could be back for Brighton, but playing through a bit of pain, maybe.
I'd like to think that he was just feeling it and he didn't actually pull anything or just say strain anything. He was obviously getting some treatment during the game. And I don't know. I reckon it was probably tight before the game, if I'm being totally honest. I think on Olsen and Gauci, Olsen will play for sure. But yeah, I think you need to look to the Premier League games, really. It's a real blow if he's out for Brighton and onwards. The way Villa play, it's, you know, I saw a video the other day about... how Guardiola basically uses the goalkeeper, and it's not like a secret or anything, but it gives you that extra player on the pitch. When Martinez is standing with his studs on the ball for however long he does, the longest in the Premier League, it allows Villa to find teammates, find patterns, find holes in the opposition's structure, I suppose. So it's going to be a big miss if he is out for one Premier League game, let alone the three. Of course, we'll get behind Olsen, you know, he gets a lot of kind of stick because he isn't Martinez, which is, you know, difficult. And naturally, because the way we play is so orientated around Martinez, building from the back, you know, there's always going to be kind of jitters when Olsen does it and can't do it to the level. So, yeah, it is a worry, but we'll see what Emery says on Wednesday. I pray that he just says, you know, he's all right, he's training. And I'll be like, oh, thank God. But yeah, we'll see. I don't know. I'd have thought he'd missed training for the whole week, to be honest, even if it is just tightness, because why would you take a risk? I don't think Martinez needs to be training full on. He can maybe train on the Saturday, hopefully anyway, before Brighton, yeah. if he's able to. Again, we don't know whether it comes out before Wednesday, as I say, when Emery talks, I'm not sure. But yeah, the other one as well, Tielemans, that's a massive blow for Villa too.
That's a big one, yeah.
Two midfielders plus Tim. But I've said in the preview, he needs to be playing further forward for me, and it allows us to take control of games when Tielemans is playing.
Tielemans is going to be a big blow. I don't think he'll play again. I don't know anything. If I had to guess, I don't think he'll be available for the rest of the season. Martinez, hopefully, is back for Brighton, even if he only misses one game, that's bad enough. Fingers crossed on him more so, I suppose. James says, as a few have asked, is there any update on when the new badge or shirt or anything else will be announced? Assuming it won't be until the end of the season, but given how notoriously late we are with shirt releases, it'd be good to know. I would assume, so we spoke about the badge, didn't we? First week of January, that it was expected that it's going to be like imminently now.
Yeah,
I would imagine it possibly got to a stage where it was like, okay, let's not have any off-pitch distractions. Let's have full focus on the pitch, and we can sideline all these announcements and whatnot till later. And talk of the Adidas deal for ages, that it's well known that will be the case, but Villa haven't actually confirmed anything yet, probably due to existing contracts with Castor that they cannot say anything yet. So it's going to be the end of the season for all this kind of stuff. To announce the new badge now, when we've got a massive game in both Europe and the Premier League coming up, it's like, why have any kind of distractions?
Possibly. Hex said the other day that he's gearing up for the new generation, I think it was, of our brand. I presume the summer. Well, so this at the end of the season is, what, a few weeks away. So I'd be surprised if it was before then, considering everything's just happened over the last
If you've got this close to not announcing it this side of the season, why do it now? Why not just wait till May the 20th or May the 30th?
Yeah, and on the kind of Villa always releasing late kit stuff, we've got a new guy at the helm now. And if he wants to release those kits before, or before closer to the start of the season, as we usually do, then we will do that, because I never really knew why that was the case anyway. Yeah, if it suits financially or because of revenue or because of the brand, then that will change. So, yeah, I don't know what's going to happen this summer in terms of when they're being released, but we do know they've got big plans for merchandise. The club shop's going to expand. Obviously, the Adidas deal helps, you know, put us on that kind of pedestal now of top merchandise, top branding. So yeah, it is really exciting to see how we're gonna look next season. I know a lot has been said about the crest. You know, I guess that's up to the individual fans, what do they think about it, but I think, you know, in terms of the kit should be good. So I'm looking forward to that.
Dobby asks, last week you said that the current squad is better than the Martin O'Neill era squad. Who do you think would get into a starting 11 from that O'Neill era? A combined 11 between the two eras would be great. It's harder than it sounds. Now, I messaged you last night with this one, so you had some thinking time to actually do the task, do the homework ahead of the show. We've both built a team each. We're not going to go position by position. You just rattle me through your 11 and I'll do the same.
Martinez in goal. And mine's a little bit wild, but, you know, got to have fun. Martinez in goal. Right back is a right back who didn't play right back at Villa, but James Milner. Ezri Konsa, Pau Torres, and I went with Luca Dean. I was very close to going with like an Alex Moreno of last season, but I've gone with Luca Dean. Douglas Luiz and Gareth Barry. I was about to say Lewis Barry. Luiz and Louis Barry. Louis Barry, of course, that's why. Douglas Luiz and Gareth Barry. I've gone with Leon Bailey and Ashley Young on the wings. I've got John McGinn basically playing in that kind of supporting act, you know, kind of linking the midfield to attack, and obviously Ollie Watkins up front. Maybe that's skewed by like recency bias, but I don't know. For me, football's moved on. Football has moved on so drastically from, and this isn't to kind of put anything down on what we achieved. Well, we didn't really achieve too much. We finished sixth in the O'Neill era. But yeah, football's moved on so much that I think we would outplay that team because of how we play now. And, you know, if those players were playing in this era, then they'd be better players themselves, like for certain. So yeah, drag a few in. But I've seen that Pau Torres can do what he can do. And I've seen that, you know, Luiz Bailey is absolute dynamite at the moment. Him and Ashley Young on the wings is like a terrifying prospect, but not for Villa.
It's a nice team. My 11, similar personnel, but slightly different makeup in terms of the squad. I've also got Martinez in goal. I've got Konsa at right back and Dean at left back, which probably tells you the state of the fullbacks of the O'Neill era. I don't think there was anyone.
We never really, not since, well, I was born, we rarely had like quality for, well, last few years we have, but in that period.
Yeah, in that time when we were good, like we didn't really have standouts there. Like, Luke Young was a decent player.
Stephen Warnock
was okay. when you do like a best Premier League 11, Melberg normally ends at right back, doesn't he? Which, yeah, that says everything. I've done the same here. Konsa at right back, although that is a position that he plays for us now. I've got Larsson and Pau as the centre halves. I was tempted by Melberg, but I always say that I rate Larsson. I'll just, you know, one of my heroes, etc. So I've gone two left footers. I've also got Barry and Louise as the two in midfield. I've got Ashley Young on the left. I've got John McGinn playing off the right, which again he's used to. Yeah. And I've got a front two out and out strikers, none of this supporting lark. Ollie Watkins, obviously. And John Carew, I've gone for. Yeah. Not quite big man, little man, because Watkins isn't small, but big man and slightly smaller big man. Yeah, I feel that's chaos.
I would say that I'd like to see your team, and I do, but I think I'd just like to see John Carew playing. Just John Carew. Like, you know, whether he's playing with Watkins or not, just bring him back.
Yeah, I've kind of put like a subs bench together, which is basically honourable mentions. Friedel would be the goalkeeper. Bailey is in there. Kamara got very close to me for getting in as well. But obviously, we've not seen a lot of him this season. Melberg, as I mentioned. Milner is in there as well. I've got Gabby, but I've got prime Gabby. The one that can pop up with a goal against the Blues, rapid pace, etc. And I've stuck Petrov in there as well for an extra midfield.
Yeah, I was going to say Stan.
Next question then from John Joe, who says, if John McGinn goes on to captain us to finish in the top four and win the Europa Conference League, how highly do you think his legacy at Villa ranks compared to the others in the Premier League era? Considering he's one of the only surviving players from the Championship, and he's now gone on to be one of the best in this team, which is a point worth noting in similar mould to Tyra Mings, if he was available, to be part of a Championship side and then to be part of a Champions League qualifying side is some step up.
I'm not going to think about it like too much, but I'd have thought number one. He's won a trophy. He's lived the V Sports era. He's almost always available. A fantastic ambassador for the football club. If he gets into the top four, that's the highest finish we would have had for a very long time. You know, again, is it recency bias? I don't know. I don't think it is. He's done everything that he could possibly do. I know he's only been a captain for a period of time, but as a player, the ascent that he's been on is the same. It mirrors Villa's. And again, he played under Smith, of course, played under Bruce, played under, Gerrard. And then, you know, you would have thought, or he thought at the time, I think he said, he probably needs his name to be Juan rather than John, because, you know, he's done all of that. But then getting into a team under Unai Emery, who plays a certain brand of football, John McGinn is still playing a key role in that. And he is the captain. He'll be the captain next season. He's everything you want from a captain. And you couldn't imagine Aston Villa, or you couldn't imagine a Villa team without McGinn. Yeah. And that goes for a few players, granted. But if you take him out of it, that's a huge hole to fill. On the pitch and off the pitch sort of thing. So yeah, for me, number one. How can you really top it? I mean, I know we've had some good captains in the Premier League era, but John McGinn.
Gareth Barry would be up there, I suppose, for longevity. Andy Townsend was a cup winner in the 90s as captain.
Yeah. But Gareth Barry didn't win anything with Villa, and that would go against it. And neither was John McGinn, you know, in terms of winning his captain. But the question was if Villa win the Conference League, I don't think you can't rank Barry above that. I don't think McGinn's appearances, I know not all of them will be in the Premier League, but he must be clocking up. Gareth Barry as well. He'd probably have to play for us for another maybe two or three seasons, which will take him, you know, into his 30s again. But this is a player I can't see leaving at any point. Even if he wasn't starting, he'd be making appearances because he's that type of player that you'd want to bring off the bench anyway. Yeah, and that isn't, again, to suggest that he's not going to be a key player in the years to come. I think he will be. So, yeah, full credit to McGinn.
Jack says, what is the priority right now? Brighton or Olympiacos?
Olympiacos, then Brighton. As in, we play Olympiacos, then Brighton. I don't...
is there any small part of you that's thinking this Olympiacos game is not as important because it's all about top four?
No, because I get the question, but I think this is us thinking that we don't have Unai Emery as manager. Like, for him, it's just that game, then it's that game, then it's that. And that's worked this season. We're in fourth and we're nearly in a final. Like
I've said before, didn't we? It almost works better when we've got these guys having the week preparation for Chelsea. Didn't exactly go well, did it?
Yeah, and we got two injuries and in that room we didn't. You know, it's mad. But the Olympiacos game is the biggest game of the season. Then it'll be Brighton. Then it'll be Olympiacos second leg. That's just how it is. And that's how we roll. It's how we have rolled this season. And we'll continue to do that, and it's worked. You know, Emery will have his 17th consecutive year in Europe next year. It's mad. So Yeah, like absolutely understand the question. And if, I don't know, if you asked me differently, would you make subs if Villa went 2-0 up or whatever? Then I don't know, possibly. But you know, there's no way that we go into that Olympiacos game thinking anything about Brighton. If anything, I quite like that we have these European matches. It helps kind of break up, not the pressure, but I don't know. Do you know, do you kind of get what I'm saying, Dan? Instead of building up a whole week of we need to beat Brighton, we need to do this, we need to do that, which is what Tottenham have had. Instead, it kind of allows us to think about something different. And I don't know if that really plays a part, but for me, if there's any way, I quite like that we'd like delve into Olympiacos, right? This competition, we're two games away from the final, and then, right, that's done. Right now, Brighton, let's prepare for this and get it done. Yeah. I don't know. I quite like that approach, and maybe that is why we've done so well, because we can kind of, without overthinking stuff or overplaying expectation or whatever it may be, I just, I think European games have actually helped us this season, to be honest.
Bob says, good morning, Dan and John. Good result last night. A point is a point further away from Spurs. I think if we beat Brighton and Spurs lose the next two, that is us in the Champions League, which we discussed earlier. My question is, do you know when Tara Mings and Emi Buendia are due back? And we kind of thought, didn't we, maybe at the back end of the season, they might just about feature. Buendia, I think, probably more likely than Mings. Is it feasible to think for one of them to maybe make the bench in these remaining couple?
I'd be surprised if we see them in a matchday squad, and that's okay. What Emery said back in, was it February or March, he didn't expect them to be playing or featuring or whatever, but he was hopeful they'd both return to kind of group training, which they are doing. Mings, he's seeing his teammates back on the pitch now, same as Buendia, but there's no rush, is there? We don't need either of them to come back and make a difference, because I don't think that would be fair anyway to throw one of them back in, even if they were fit. We've got here, and this is in the nicest possible way, we've got here without them, so we don't need to rush them back for any reason. No need. But then we will need them next year when we don't have Longley, when we don't have Zaniolo. I doubt either of them sign permanently. So then all of a sudden they are, again, massive parts of the squad.
Yeah, absolutely.
Every player has a huge part. So, I think we've done really well to deal without them. And I know a lot has been said about Zaniolo or whatever. We were never going to get a better player than Zaniolo on loan or for free or whatever it may be, with a few days of the window remaining, which is never going to happen. So I think he gets a lot of stick, Zaniolo, but I think a lot of it's kind of unjust. He's not going to be the greatest player in the world, but that's not what we needed or what we could afford or get. So anyway, they'll come back for pre-season. Hopefully they can build themselves up well, properly train, even if it takes them a month or something into the new season or however long they need, that's okay. Just as long as they're back and they're ready and they're strong, they're fully fit, they're ready to go, then that's the deal, because they had really bad injuries. So, they're kind of, not so like career threatening, but that can really take its toll on you as a person and as a player when you come back. So it's really important. And Villa have got a really good medical team that they'll be back ready and prepared and strong to actually make a difference in the season next year.
The next section of the show is all about the Champions League. Obviously, a lot of these things are, we talk about them now, but in a couple of weeks, if we don't finish in the Champions League places, a lot of this stuff becomes not relevant. But we're here in the moment. Everyone's watching this in the moment, so it is relevant for now. James says, how much of a difference will qualifying for the Champions League versus not qualifying for it make to our summer transfer business? Now, you kind of hear a lot, don't you, about in the Championship, if we get promoted, we're going to do this. If we don't, we're going to have to do this. We've got a plan for both scenarios. You would expect Villa have also been doing the same for a long time now. If we finish in the Champions League, this is our list of targets. This is what we think we can achieve. This is what our budget might be. And if we finish in the Europa League, or even before the last week, if it's the Conference League again, kind of we'll have different plans for that as well. That's the most likely, isn't it?
Yeah, but I don't think it'll be drastically different, if I'm being totally honest. The Champions League will absolutely help Villa financially, but I think it's almost like there's a long-term aspect to it as well. It allows Villa to get better sponsorships. It allows Villa to, gate receipts, all that sort of stuff. That will help later down the line as well. In terms of this summer, we know that Villa are close to the PSR threshold as such. So I wouldn't expect them to be spending, huge amounts of money. Possibly a few years ago, that would be the case if they were in the Champions League, because players didn't cost as much and wages weren't so incredibly high as they are now. But what I'd say is that Villa, we've seen already Monchi can sign Rodgers and Emery can improve him by nearly tenfold in a space of weeks if they can just get the recruitment correct. You know, this team has finished, or will have, if we get the Champions League, the fourth best team in England without injuries, it would be on closer to 80 points. That's remarkable. And that's for this group of players. And I know you always have to try and improve to, you know, if you don't improve, sorry, you go backwards basically. But under Emery, this group of players have proven that they can do it. So I don't think there needs to be wholesale changes. Firstly, we can't do that. But secondly, I don't think that's needed. I'm not begging for a few £50 million players to come through the door because I don't think that's what we need. We need players who are going to beef out the squad and allow some players to take a breather or allow them to come out of the fire as such. You know, Konsa has played all the games this season. He'll be absolutely knackered come the end of it. He's played right back. He's played centre back. I just want Ezri Konsa to play at centre back. Yes, he can do the right back stuff, but play in your best position, play next to Torres. That all of a sudden, we have two fantastic centre-backs. We have Mings as well, who's going to come into that. Carlos, we don't know what's going to happen with him in the summer. There is interest in him. Just as an example, though, and then Konsa doesn't have to always shift to right-back and we're disrupting the centre-back flow. The right-back you have there, you've got a cash. Then you've got maybe a new right-back who can occupy that position that Konsa did, and then they can play centre-back. That sort of thing, that's what we need to do for me. Because we're so thin, all of a sudden our two midfielders, that's all we've got. I know Tim is there and is available to play, but if we're talking about Champions League campaign, we need proper strength and depth there. So, you know, a midfielder, a player who can play in those positions that that Konsa is occupied. What's going to happen in the left back situation? The wingers, you know, Diaby. Hopefully, he continues to adapt and improve. Ramsey, Rodgers. That's another question mark. The strikers, Watkins, the Ran. I think there's holes in the squad in different places that don't need to be plugged by players who are going to command £200,000 a week. I don't think that's what Villa need. I think what they need is maybe a young player or an experienced player, like different dynamics in different parts of the squad, but ultimately just to improve and beef it up a bit. You know, then all of a sudden we're not going into next season thinking, oh, well, if this player gets injured, what's going to happen there? Because we'll have Kamara and another holding player who can do that role. For me, that's what we need, because then it'll allow us to do the Tuesday, Wednesday to the weekend with like minimal fuss, even with an injury or two, because it'll happen next season. I know there's loads of injuries happening at the moment, but, you know, it's for a reason, and that's because football isn't being asked to play so much. It's not going to stop. Next season, we'll have injuries again. So we need to just mitigate against that. And again, I don't think we have to spend loads and loads of money to do it. And I almost don't want to, because I don't want to put pressure on the financial side. I just want to improve the team with excellent recruitment. Emery will do the rest, because that's his role. And that
in itself, signings into 50 million signings. We don't need to go out. And I don't think there's a desire for me either to go and... Villa might spend 100 million, for example. The figures are, you know, variable on the sales we make and whatever else. And as we said before, if Douglas Luiz leaves, he needs replaced, and that's going to be a big ass, whatever.
Yeah.
Let's say Villa spend 100 million as a figure. Some people will say quality over quantity, two £50 million players would add more quality to the side. But you could sign five £20 million signings, and Emery will turn them into 40, 50 million signings and make them better. Previous coaches and other clubs buy these big players who are already good. They nick them from another club and just expected them to kind of plug and play. Here you go. You were good before. Go and do it again. Yes. For Emery, you've got to find somebody who's maybe, it's not quite the money ball approach, but somebody who is not quite maybe doing it at their club, or maybe you think is on the decline or whatever. Yuri Tiedemann's on a free transfer is almost a perfect example of that. Other clubs aren't looking at him. Why not? Well, we see something in him. We can add him into our squad and, yeah, big wage packet and whatever else. But overall, that's a good deal for us. So, you know, four or five signings of that calibre and the right personalities to me is more important than signing a 70 million Mudrick, for example. You go, what a waste of time that was.
Exactly that.
Yeah, big fee, looks sexy and whatever, but ultimately it doesn't work.
Yeah.
the business looks sexy, by the way. He doesn't.
That is the point, yeah, that we're trying to get across. You know, Villa's summer activity. I think previously, if you said to Villa fans, oh, you'll be in the Champions League in 3 years, straight away you'd be thinking, oh my God, 60, 70 million pound player, 50 million pound player, which player are we going to buy and we're going to plug in that's just going to do it? I'm less infused by that these days, because it can go wrong for a start. I don't think it would under Emery and Monchi. You know, that's not what I'm saying. But they're big risks that I just don't think Villa need to take, especially with the climate that they're working in. I know that today, that in fact the Premier League, the clubs are voting on a new financial kind of regulation or new rules as such. I need to read into it to properly understand exactly how that impacts Villa. But from the outset, it looks like it would be more beneficial than not, shall I say. Put it this way, it's not going to benefit Man United and Man City, which means it will probably help Villa. Or anyone else for that matter. So we'll see what happens with that. But the main point is that even if Villa had an absolute war chest, I still think there's a part of Emery that would rather, as you say, Dan, just recruit responsibly and do it in the right way, buy the right players and the right fits. And you're absolutely bang on with the, you know, he'll make players into £50 million players, or, you know, Rodgers has already tripled his price tag. You're right. But there's scope to do other things. There's scope to bring in more experienced players as well for me. Like, this is going to sound mad, but last year when I said about Benjamin Andre, right, for Lille, who, fantastic player, he wouldn't have cost, you know, much at all last season. But my point was that we just need to plug a hole there, because he can come in and he can operate when Kamara isn't playing. And that's just a good player to have in your squad. He can probably play for another 2 or 3 years at a good level. And that's all right, because he won't cost loads of wages and his transfer fee will be minimal. And I know he missed the penalty against Villa, but, you know, he scores the header, plays well in both legs. That's just a very solid, good player. And there's loads of them around. And this is where the good recruitment comes into it. So, yeah, I fully expect Villa to, whatever happens in the summer, be in, if not equal, better place than where they are now. And I know that sounds mad, but again, we don't know what's going to happen with the summer window in terms of outgoings. Will there be massive bids for some of our players? And we'll have to see what happens there. You know, you'd like to think that we can hold on to all of our players. But if there's an opportunity, if someone puts in huge money for a player, we'll really look at it and think, well, we can reinvest it there and there, and we'll be better off for it. That's the conversation. And that's why I think we'll be better off anyway. It's going to be a summer where we get linked with some players. Our players will be linked elsewhere. But come the end of it, I think we'll be in a good position.
Not a question from the audience, but just something I wanted to spin off from the conversation we've just had about experience. And this might just be maybe an outdated point from years gone by, or kind of a lazy point. This is dependent on if we get to the Champions League. Yeah. Do you think we need to recruit one player, two players, whatever it is, who have Champions League experience? Do you think that is important, that not many of this squad will have done it? Obviously, the manager has, in Europe at least, and has played in the has managed in the Champions League, but more so Europa League is what he's known for. So you kind of trust that, well, whatever he does, the players will get on board with it anyway, and they have shown that this year. How many players in this squad have got Champions League experience? Torres, Bailey, Diaby.
But nothing of, when it's the Champions League experience, you know, you're talking a season, maybe two, for some of our players.
Of longevity.
Could equate to like six games, not six. If it's 2 years, what would that be like? Two lots of group stage games. It's not, I know Torres went to the semi-final, but when you say experience, I know what you're saying, Dan. It's playing.
Yeah, someone who's been in the competition for 5 or 6 years for different clubs. Yeah, exactly that. Yeah, Torres might have 20 appearances in the Champions League, but do we need someone who's played it 50 times?
Yeah, and we have players who've played in big moments and in big games, and I think the Conference League helps them because of that, because we've had the Lille experience. Hopefully the Olympiacos experience will be smooth in the final too. But I think there's definitely scope for that. It'll be a big tick for Monchi and Emery if they have experience in the Champions League. Again, we're talking about bolstering the squad here. If they've got Champions League experience and they come into the 11, they're probably costing a lot of money. But if they come in and they're playing backup at holding midfield, or even as a striker, you know, an older striker, for example, absolutely, because they're good for the dressing room. And that's, again, it's not a bad thing, is it? So, I'd be more than happy to see a couple of older heads come into the squad. Next year is a season where, you know, we're going to hopefully continue to build, but that doesn't mean that we have to sign teenagers. And I know we've done that recently and we'll continue to do it, because that's how you're going to develop the player, but also the value of the player in terms of what we want to achieve next year. You know, you can't only buy young players and expect them to adapt quickly. So, I just think we'll be in a better position next year anyway, whatever happens.
Yeah, no, I'm absolutely not suggesting we sign this player. Do not get me mixed up by, I'm saying, let's go for this guy. Like a Jordan Henderson type, who has won the trophy, who's been around an elite club for a long time, who's coming to the back end of his career, he's in his mid-30s, but could still do a job. Like I said, I don't think Henderson is that player now, but somebody who is that kind of age. They've been in the Champions League for a long time. They've been a captain at a club. You know, he's got a lot of experience, whatever you think about him as a player and his morals and whatever else. But that kind of player you could see coming into Villa's, I don't know, centre midfield, or a striker option who is an older head or whatever, just someone who can go, right, well, I've been here before, I've played in these big games, and that might help us a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't doubt there'll be a few Spanish players and a few players from the Spanish league. There's quite a number of players who will end their career at 35 over there or even continue to play. There's probably a couple of Villarreal lads that Emery's probably looking at thinking, well, you could probably just do a job for us. I'm not saying that it's like as basic as the, you know, he looks at his former club and think, yeah, you can come in. No, they have to fit and they have to be ready to.
Yeah.
It sounds mad, but live in England as well. You know, there's an adaptation there. So it's not that simple. But in terms of how they'll play on the football pitch, Emery knows exactly what he wants. He knows that he'll be able to get it as well, as long as it's affordable. And again, that's another thing. Villa, if they're in the Champions League and they're not going for £50 million players or £60 million players, they could basically get who they like, really, unless that player is, you know, contracted until whatever. But do you get what I'm saying? We're such an attractive proposition. We have a huge pool of players to pick from. You know, you can probably just handpick what you like. Again, if the recruitment's correct, there's a big opportunity there to increase the squad, buy a few more players and add proper experience or proper, I suppose, like promising, exciting players as well. Again, players that can increase the value.
Okay. The next couple of questions we're going to couple together because they're about outgoings and we've kind of touched on it, so we can probably go through these pretty quickly. 723OJ says, if we don't get Champions League, do you think that Villa could be raided or players will want to leave in search of Champions League football? I think it's integral we achieve top four just to keep this group of players together. And Dan says, if one player had to be sold in the summer for FFP reasons, been here before, don't think it will, but let's pretend, who would you choose? And the first point about players wanting to leave, I don't know, you know, some may, but I'd like to think that a fifth place finish in the Europa League next year with Unai Emery is signs of progression and next year we might get the Champions League anyway, so I'm going to stay. Some might think, no, I've had enough time to go, but I don't know, I'm not sure I'll get that vibe from this squad.
I think if you, yeah, and some of our players have improved so, I don't know, take Watkins for example. I'm not saying he would feel lost without Unai Emery, but I think he'll feel uncomfortable
because he's
improved so much and he is now to a level where he is world class, one of the best strikers in the world.
They may move and it not work for him. They think, I wish I'd stayed at Villa.
Yeah, and don't get me wrong, I don't want to talk about it, but if Watkins played for a different team, I'm sure he'd be absolutely fine. But as a player, what is really the incentive for you to leave just to play a bit of Champions League football when you know that you could then do it probably next season with Villa anyway? Because we've seen over this campaign, and we've said previously, every question mark that could be asked of Villa next season as to why they wouldn't compete in both Champions League, Europa League or Premier League, they've answered this season. They've had injuries. They've had lots of different things go against them. This is their first, for a lot of those players, their first season in Europe. For Aston Villa, their first season in Europe for a long time. They've gone all the way. You know, unless we get knocked out, it's still going to be the whole season because the Conference League is then after the season ends for the Premier League. Yeah. Every question's been answered. So these players know that even at the end of the season, they probably think, you know what, we could probably have more points on the board if these things happened. I'm not saying they would have underachieved as such because that's just mental to say, but you kind of understand what I'm saying. There's more to achieve with Villa, I think, is what their thinking would be, even if we were to finish out the top four. So yeah, I don't really, there's like no issue for there for me. I don't think
there's anyone in this squad that would look at their career and think this is kind of like last chance saloon either. If I don't get into the Champions League now, I'm never going to do it because I'm kind of running out of time, so I have to leave to go and do it.
No, and you know, there will be a few players there who are kind of entering that period, I think. But Villa, Villa hold the cards in this situation still, although PSR is, they're still going to manage where if a big bid comes in, there'll be a certain number, even for some players, there might not be a number, but there might be numbers for others. And it'll be a case of, well, if you meet this, we can then buy these three players to improve us by this much. And these are Unai Emery signings. Unai Emery signings so far have all worked. And we've only had a few of them, I suppose you could say. And people probably look at the RB and say, well, this didn't work this season that much, but we've seen flashes and we know, again, it's a big adaptation for the RB, more so than the Torres. I would say Rodgers, but even Rodgers, you know, he hasn't played in the Premier League, but he's been around the Man City squad. He's played under Pep Guardiola. He has played in English football. He's played against some of the opponents that's played in the Premier League this season already. So, you know, he's done extremely well. But for Diaby, some players just take a little bit longer. We've seen it with Bailey. We've already seen flashes from him. So, my roundabout point is that Villa will decide what they want to do and no one will really influence that. And I think the players are so committed and so aware of, you know, what they can achieve at Villa. That again, even if someone was to go, we'll be okay next year anyway. Like, this isn't a situation where we're punching above our weight and it's like, how have we got here with this group of players or this manager? Or, you know, the owners haven't spent too much. We're like a juggernaut at the moment. The only thing that would stop us is if we had to sell a few players, but I don't think that's the case. I don't think that would be a situation where Villa have to offload more than one, because that all of a sudden would be, you know, hampering your progress. If we had to do it just to stay compliant or to build or rebuild, shall I say, then that's okay. Because, as I say, under Emery and Monchi, we'll be all right. It's the recruitment there to bring in another few players because of that would probably put us in a better position.
Yeah, I'm not going to pick the one player. I think we've definitely had this conversation before anyway, but I think the way that Unai Emery and his coaching staff have kind of taught us as fans as well to adapt to his style of play, to trust in the players, to carry out certain plans, to play out from the back and be calm and all that kind of stuff, that we as Villa fans now feel a lot more educated about what is going on than we did 18 months ago. I think our mentality has to change in regards to recruitment as well. The players will go. Players that you love, players that you've got on the back of your shirt, players that you watch week in, week out, go, he's brilliant. They will leave at some point, but we've got to kind of hope and trust that what we've seen so far will be that if Douglas Luiz does go to Arsenal for 100 million this year, that's 100 million for Unai Emery to invest back in this side. And if those two or three signings that they make makes us better than we were with Douglas Luiz, which is likely going to finish fourth, that's a great position to be in and something that we just have to go, this is football now.
Tottenham, for example, they sell Harry Kane, their everything, their Jack Grealish as such, for £100 million, and they're better. You know, maybe they would be better even if Harry Kane was there, but you get my point. You know, it's really not the end of the world. The Grealish thing, I think, scarred us for different reasons. We were new to the Premier League. We were like, oh, this is unknown. What, you know, that sort of thing. But yeah, we'll be okay next year, whatever happens. And this isn't, by the way, saying that we have to do this or we have to do that. It's just if we were to have to sell one player, then there'll be a reason behind it. And that reason, I think we'll make up we'll make up the negative into a positive as such, because
yeah, 100%.
I just think that with that amount of money, we'd be able to improve anyway. Hopefully we don't have to. But yeah, it's like, although it sounds negative, we're kind of talking it as a positive.
Yeah, but I think that's just life now. I think that's just the way we deal with this in our side. First up, we can do this one quick, so we've definitely spoken about this before. Joel says, would you be happy seeing Blues get relegated? I would be happy to see them promoted so we can get the derby back. Imagine this season where Villa finished fourth and we've beaten Small Heath twice. Nah, not for me. I don't want them in the Premier League. Would I be happy if they got relegated? Yeah.
I'll be honest, I've always said this, it can't peak.
What does it add to our Alan season Hutton, to play Blues twice?
Alan Hutton goes from the halfway line and scores in front of the whole end, and then Jack Grealish gets assaulted and then scores the winner. You're not going to get better than that. You're just not. So, like, fine if we play Blues and derbies again, but I know that I'm not going to feel any better than what I did back then. I don't really care. Villa are going for the top four, and Blues have been so... not trying to stoke it, but they've been so irrelevant for us for a long time. Even when we were in the Championship, they were nowhere. Mm. You know, for the 1 year, they were relatively close to us. There was the whole kind of mind the gap stuff for a couple of weeks, and then it ended. But apart from that, in my lifetime anyway, there's been no... how do I say it? There's only been jeopardy on Villa in those games, if that makes sense. If Villa didn't win or they lost the match, then, you know, it would be kind of like crisis, and I've never... experienced it before, like properly, and unless I was a baby. So yeah, I don't know. We've got to kind of be a bit careful, I suppose, because we work in it, but let's just say I don't care.
Okay, let's move on. Talking of work, actually, Ollie says, I'm curious, what is a day in the life like for both of you guys in your respective jobs, and what's it like for the players? I don't really know anything about training schedules and other stuff. Players is an interesting one, isn't it? Obviously they're in Bodymore doing gym work and tactics and meetings and stuff. That's about it, isn't it, really? Right. And that's it.
Yeah, it's training in the morning and then lunch. And then afterwards, they'll go home after doing some tactical bits or...
recovery sessions and stuff.
Recovery sessions, yeah.
Our days look pretty similar, don't they, John? Bit of
to them.
Work. Yeah. Go home at 12, I wish. Yeah. My working day is much less... sexy than yours would be. I suppose we're talking about game days here, aren't we? More so than just day to day. We work from home, we turn on a computer, we type some words, we film some videos. That's kind of it, really. I actually had a couple of people recently asking me about like work experience and stuff, and it's like, well, not really much I can do, really, because it's not like we're out on the road and we're heading off to different places and doing this, that, and the other. A lot of the stuff we do is sat behind a computer.
Journalism's changed that we rarely work in offices nowadays. This is, you know, journalism or working in the media is like a 24, well, not literally 24/7, but well, news doesn't stop, right? So, you know, we have shift patterns, but it tends to be you wake up and you don't, well, I don't know, in my case anyway, not trying to be that guy, but well, firstly, this is the job that I love and I wouldn't do anything otherwise than this. So,
no, I wouldn't, I wouldn't change it.
So it's like, wake up, and my partner will shout at me for it, but kind of don't kind of close the laptop until, I don't know, like you go to bed sort of thing, because there's always something going on or something to prepare for the next day. But there's no day is kind of the same because different things happen. So I suppose on a match day, I don't know if it's like a 3 o'clock, get to the ground a few hours before the game, do the match, press conference after, probably get home at like 7, and then you've got all the stuff to do for the morning, so you probably don't go to bed until the early hours of the morning. But it's all fun if Villa win, sort of thing. if Villa don't win, it's horrible because you've got to live it twice. There's no escape. You know what I mean? Of course, you know what I mean, Dan. You work.
Yeah, I know how this goes, yeah.
It's not fun when Villa have a disappointing result. Like that Man United game on Boxing Day, that was horrible because it puts me obviously in a bad mood when Villa don't win anyway, but there's no escape from it. I was a moody git for about 2 days afterwards. So I rarely even spoke to my family around Christmas because of this game, and it really got to me. Like that's how sad it is. But the work doesn't help because, of course, you've still got, you know, you've just got to stay professional with it. But it's difficult when things don't go as you like, should we say.
Yeah, if you've got to simplify it, the match and 10 tasks around it to do, press conference, previews, podcasts, post-match, whatever else, the result doesn't affect, you still have to do those 10 things around it. So this season has been great. We've largely been talking about Villa wins and being in for this top four race. Years gone by, if you're mid-table and you win a few and you lose a few, the wins are like, that's great, great to talk about it. Here we go, nice to talk about a win. But you know that it's probably going to be 2 or 3 weeks of talking about consecutive defeats because that's just where we are, it's up and down. Whereas now, defeats hurt so much more because you have to win every single week to stay where you are. So you have to relive it all, which I was like, oh, take pity on us, we have to relive it on a podcast. You don't get to full time and just get forget about it a day later. It's like, I've still got to do all those tasks even though we've lost. So this season has been unbelievable, and despite what may appear to be moaning about late nights or oh no, we've lost, we've got to do some work, I would not change a thing with this job at all.
I would feel absolutely, if I didn't have this job or if I was doing something else, I'd feel absolutely lost. I would be doing it for free, I think.
Let's move on then. Let's move on indeed from a serious discussion about how important journalism is and how seriously we take this job, John. Mardi Grumper says, would you rather have a toe growing out of your elbow or a toe growing on your knee?
You'd probably say elbow, because no matter what you wear on, no matter if you wear trousers, shorts, whatever it may be, there's always a visible lump sticking out of your knee, right? But if you wear a coat, like a puffer jacket or even a jumper, I don't think it'd be that obvious. And it's also behind you as well, so even you don't see it.
That is true. How often do you look at your elbows? Precisely.
When you said that, I had flashbacks. I had, not toe, but when I was growing up, I had a thing called Oschgutschlatters, which is like on your knee. It's basically like a bone that sticks out of your knee. So I've kind of had similar. Quite painful, it's when you... I mean, if anyone's bumped into me in real life, the first thing they say is, I didn't know you're that small. So when I was growing, which for some people would be a shock, I was doing like a lot of sport and a lot of, you know, I was running around too much basically, and your bones in your knee kind of aren't. Anyway, it kind of sticks out and then you get like a big lump on it. I think Rashford had it. So if you want to look at that, it's like a lump that comes out your knee. So I had that for a few years.
Was that the same as a toe might be? Was it visible through clothing?
Toe would be more of a point, wouldn't it? Whereas it was more of like a lump. So it was less visible and less kind of there, but it did hurt. And don't think the toe would hurt. So I would definitely say elbow.
Now, we've got a Villa one here, and I did ask you to do some thinking. Whether you actually did or not is we're about to find out. AVSD Faithful says, if the Aston Villa players were characters in a heist movie, who would be the mastermind, the smooth talker, the tech genius, the muscle, and the getaway driver? Now, I've had a think about this, and when I say I think, about 10 seconds. So the first one is the mastermind behind the heist.
Mings.
Oh, interesting, yeah. An intelligent man. Yeah, fair. I forgot about Tyrone Mings. That's a John McGinn.
Okay. Intelligent man, I presume.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I thought longevity, like, been here a lot, would have, you know, trust in him as, like, he's been here a long time.
I thought longevity, what?
Well, like, he's been in the squad a lot. Everyone respects him, and he'd be he's kind of top dog. He's a leader already, so he's the leader of the heist.
All right, I hope he doesn't win for. Yeah, I hope he doesn't lead them the wrong way then. You know, the mastermind, it's a lot of pressure. Yeah, I went with Mings. Mings is, I think Mings is a safe bet there.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. Smooth talker?
Ezri Konsa.
Ooh, nice. Why is that? What's the reasoning for that?
Smooth guy, silky. I bet he's... Yeah, he probably talks like he defends effortless, you know what I mean? No issues at all.
I went for Ollie Watkins for this one. Because I kind of felt like a smooth talker, got to be a bit of a charmer, charisma, back yourself, kind of talk yourself out of a situation. I could see Ollie Watkins doing that, confidence, yeah. What was the next one? Tech genius.
What is this? Sorry. You're just saying things. I missed the whole point of it. You just...
The tech genius, which is probably the guy who's going to disable alarms and stuff so you can sneak in. And, you know, that's what that means in that sense, a getaway driver. So tech genius. We don't know enough about the players to know who's into their, you know, gadgets and whatnot. So this one is a shot in the wind, shot in the dark.
I'm going for Joe Gauci.
Why?
I don't know. I just, he comes across as if he knows what he's doing with his iPads and stuff. And I'm also kind of going under, this isn't like a particularly positive thing for Joe Gauci, I suppose, but kind of like a mad scientist vibe. I kind of get that from him as well. Don't even know why. Like coding and stuff is probably something that I could see Joe Gauci doing.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Like intelligence, but also like a bit mad. And I think that is probably Joe Gauci. Don't know. Just going off it.
Yeah, interesting reasonings. I've gone for Pau Torres. And when I sort of put 10 seconds of thought in, he was probably 1 second. I couldn't think of anyone for this one, really. I just thought he's controls things at the back. So he could.
I suppose like under pressure if he's.
Yeah, bomb defusal or something. Muscle. Couple of contenders for this, but only one obvious one for me.
Yeah, that's obvious. Diego Carlos.
Yeah. Just look at him when he takes his top off. Unbelievable. Nothing needs to be more said about that one. Could have had Tyrone Mings, but you've picked him elsewhere. Getaway driver. For me, I think there's only one answer here as well. Martinez. Calm and composed in stressful situations, but also a bit mental. And if he has to ride up a curb or spin a 180, he'd just do it.
I wouldn't go with John Duran. I'd go with Leon Bailey.
Okay.
I feel like he probably likes his fast cars. I don't know. Just get the vibe that he's they'd be in a familiar situation. Not saying that he'd be speeding. You know what I mean? He knows how to operate a fast car. They probably all do.
Right. Two left to go for this long podcast. I've been recording a long time. Jay says, which two players would you pick to compete in a three-legged race together? Are you aware of what the three-legged race is?
I could guess, but I don't know why.
You never done a three-legged race at Sports Day or anything?
No.
Two of you next to each other, and say if we're stood next to each other, my right leg is attached to your left leg. So we've both got our external leg, and the one in the middle is joint, three-legged. Your right.
Oh, okay.
In the middle, you have to kind of hop along together. So any standouts for you? They've got to be a similar height. I would say you and me, I'm not massively tall, but we're not the same height. So I think we'd be kind of dragging each other along a little bit.
I reckon Mings and Konsa, because they know each other. That offside trap works easily. And they're also tall, which means that even if they're not, I mean, they are quite quick, but you basically just hop long distance.
I was going to say Torres and Konsa for the same reason. They play together a lot, got a partnership, got an understanding or whatever.
Same reason.
On the pitch. Yeah, exactly. Easy, that one. And finally then, the last question of this massively long Q&A. Silly question from Nope, who says, what animal do you think would be the best at playing football? Like, if any were to have a career, what would it be? And a bonus, where would they play positionally?
I've got a very easy answer. None of them can play football. I know that's a bit serious. So I'm going straight for goalkeeper and elephant.
Just to stand in the way of the goal.
Yeah, because... Like, you can joke about it, but what are you going to say? Turtle playing up front or cheetah on the wings is quick.
I love that you take these so seriously. It's excellent. I mean, I thought the easy answer that you were going to say is some kind of monkey, some kind of chimp, gorilla.
I know that sounds literally...
human-like, though. Like a silverback gorilla could be upright and
A silverback group. Yeah, I mean, you'd probably...
You'd probably win one of them, would you?
Also would get sent off, though. So again, I know it's literal, but an elephant would just stand there and have the best chance of blocking the ball.
Yeah.
I think once again, I've come up with the correct answer.
Let us know in the comments down below which animal you think will be the best footballer. That's always our little kind of...
Where would you play the gorilla? As if he'd stick to his position.
I had a bit of thinking time then to see if there was any like jungle-related puns to a position, but I can't think of anything. So, defender, just a bit of a bruiser, right back maybe, up and down.
Side trap, you'd get lost. I'd just put him in midfield.
Handball all the time anyway, when he's a gorilla. Just keep picking it up.
Yeah, handball. Yeah, this is my
handball.
Point.
Multiple handball sent off, done.
If you put an elephant in goal, you could at least play your game. You just can play out from the back.
I wonder if there's an argument that you could suggest a player that would be so ineffective that you wouldn't notice them and they wouldn't impact the game and you just kind of play as 10. Do you know what I mean? Like you put a flea at left back. You go, well, no one can see him. He's not going to do anything. He's not going to touch the ball.
Hold on, a flea? Is a flea an animal?
Like a tiny insect, yeah? Like a little cockroach
ladybird
or something. Yeah, like they're not going to do anything. No one's going to know. You just play with 10 men. Maybe that's the realistic answer because you could score past an elephant. It's not going to fill the goal. You just walk up to it, slotted bottom corner. It's not going to move, is it?
If you put an elephant...
It wouldn't fill the entire goal. There'd be a gap and you'd just walk up, you'd roll it in.
You say walk up, you've got to beat the defence. If you went from long range, you'd still struggle because if an elephant is sitting down in his goal, you've got to realise an elephant is massive. A goal is big. Yeah, it's no bigger than the size of this room. An elephant would, you know what I mean, fill the room. He'd probably fill the goal. I think it'd be sound. If anything... You're not going to concede. So I think it's fine.
Oh, I think I could score past an elephant.
Not if he's sitting down and blocking the goal. No way.
Oh, I don't think it would fill the entire goal.
It would. An elephant. An elephant is massive.
If
you jumped up, you'd be able to touch the goal. So could I. And I'm small. Yeah. And I'm talking about an elephant.
Yeah.
I'm no bigger than an elephant's foot.
Still gaps, though, I reckon.
Oh, smallest gap ever.
The average goal size is 24 feet by 8 feet. You'll be a big elephant to fill the entire frame that you can't even get.
Well, you know what? It's a good thing that elephants are big then, isn't it? An elephant fills the goal, surely. If he's lying down or, you know, sitting down, basically, if you say to an elephant, sleep in the goal.
Nah, it's gaps. Definitely a gap. 100% there's a gap.
100%. Elephants are also quite intelligent and use their trunk. Would you rather have an elephant in goal or a flea at left back?
Well, I think there's an argument to be had that you pick an animal that does not interfere with play and you just crack on 10v11. I think that's a genuine thing.
An elephant in goal would be better than almost most, probably every goalkeeper in the world. No,
I'm not having this. I need to
get... If he fills the goal, yeah, of course, because it's the smallest gap possible. They'd keep aiming for that gap. All you've got to do is shuffle them on to either side. Do you know what I mean?
I need to get, not for now, because we're massively running over and this is getting away from us, the average size of an elephant and put it into the average size of a goal. I reckon if you've got the goals like this big, right, I'm using my fingers here for those that are watching. I think if the microphone is the elephant, I think it's too
wide. But an elephant isn't that small.
I think it'd be like that and the big gap somewhere.
Yeah, but he wouldn't be standing, he'd be lying down. So he's with the width of an elephant. Do you know what I mean? It's huge.
No, I'm not having that. Right, well, I'm going to have to call it there because we're going to get caught up in this. If you've watched this far into this, that's what I want to hear about. What elephant? What animal is best to become a footballer? That's if we know who's watched right till the very end. As always, that sparked the biggest debate. This podcast should just be rebranded as a animal nonsense questions because that's my favourite part, to be honest. I keep them coming. There is loads of content coming up on Claret and Blue this week. Olympiacos is Thursday, Brighton Sunday. We're going to have previews, post-matches. We've got a video tomorrow coming out called Can Villa Win the Premier League One Day? Bear with us, all right? Hear us out. Loads of stuff coming up, so stay tuned. Thank you, John, for your time, insight and effort, as always. Thank you for watching or listening, and we'll see you tomorrow, the day after. We're here a lot, so thanks for watching. See you then.